What if I told you that America has been conducting secret assassinations for decades with presidential approval? Annie Jacobson's Surprise, Kill, Vanish exposes the CIA's paramilitary operations, the third option presidents choose when diplomacy fails but full-scale war seems excessive. This meticulously researched book reveals how America evolved from a nation that officially banned assassination to one that normalized targeted killing as standard policy. The implications are profound. Have we crossed a moral line? And what happens when the tactics we perfect are eventually turned against us? In 1942, as Nazi forces executed brutal reprisals against Czech civilians following Reinhard Heydrich's assassination, President Roosevelt made a fateful decision, creating the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, America's first organized intelligence agency. Under Wild Bill Donovan, the OSS recruited unconventional warriors like Aaron Bank, who trained in guerrilla warfare and assassination at secret facilities that would later become Camp David. These early operatives operated under a telling motto: Surprise, Kill, Vanish. Their missions included Operation Iron Cross, a plot to assassinate Hitler using Bank and a team disguised as Wehrmacht soldiers. The mission advanced to the point where Bank received bribe money and cyanide capsules before being canceled when U.S. Army infantry moved into the area. When World War II ended, President Truman initially abolished the OSS, believing gentlemen soldiers of a democracy shouldn't engage in ungentlemanly warfare. But this principled stance would soon collide with Cold War realities. After a chilling 1946 meeting where Stalin hinted at Soviet expansion, Truman established the CIA with special Title 50 authority for covert operations that could be plausibly denied if discovered. After CIA failures in Korea, the Army developed its own unconventional warfare capability, the 10th Special Forces Group. Named to deceive Soviets into thinking 9 other units existed, they recruited ex-OSS officers with commando experience. 12-man A-teams featured specialists in weapons, demolition, medical care, communications, and intelligence, with all members trained in at least one foreign language. These units attracted remarkable individuals, like Larry Thorne, born Laurie Tourney, who fought so effectively against Soviets that the Red Army placed a bounty on his head. After escaping imprisonment in Finland by swimming ashore near Mobile, Alabama, Thorne became a legendary Green Beret captain known for his discipline and solo operational skills. Their most shocking mission involved nuclear weapons. In 1960, green light teams trained to carry 98-pound portable nuclear devices behind enemy lines, capable of destroying areas a mile in diameter, revealing how far America would go in its shadow war against communism. During Eisenhower's final year, presidential advisors began discussing plans to assassinate foreign leaders using euphemisms like eliminating or neutralizing targets. Kennedy later formalized assassination as foreign policy under Executive Action Capability, cryptonym ZR Rifle, creating an infrastructure supporting operations with euphemisms such as direct positive action and the last resort. In 1973, the Senate's Church Committee exposed CIA assassination plots and exotic killing weapons. While Senator Church called the CIA a rogue elephant, the Pike Committee concluded the CIA never did anything the White House didn't want. This restraint ended after Reagan's near assassination in 1981. The Secret Service created the Counter-Assault Team, CAT, a permanent force shadowing the president 24/7. More critically, Reagan's team developed preemptive neutralization, killing potential assassins or terrorists before they could strike. Reagan signed Executive Order 1233, maintaining the assassination ban but leaving assassination undefined, creating flexibility for targeted killings under different terminology. This semantic maneuver allowed America to officially oppose assassination while conducting essentially the same actions. 3 weeks after South Vietnamese President Diem's CIA-backed assassination, Kennedy himself was killed. Years later, former CIA Director Richard Helms, who had overseen Kennedy's executive action capability and Castro assassination plots, ominously remarked on television, "If you kill someone else's leaders, why shouldn't they kill yours?" September 11th changed everything. CIA lawyer John Rizzo drafted a memorandum of notification containing unprecedented authorities, lethal direct action, and capture, detain, interrogate, phrases that would later become known as targeted killing and enhanced interrogation. President Bush signed it on September 17th, making the CIA, not the Department of Defense, the lead agency in the war. The Special Activities Division rapidly expanded, with a new entity called CTC/Special Operations forming with more than 50 rabidly dedicated officers scrambling in a disciplined frenzy of duty and revenge. Unlike the Pentagon's massive bureaucracy, the CIA's paramilitary arm operated with flexibility, minimal hierarchy, and the ability to make quick decisions in the field. Ken Stiles built the CIA's three-dimensional targeting map, incorporating multiple intelligence layers including Russian battle maps, NSA signals intelligence, satellite imagery, and human intelligence. This magic box revolutionized battlefield visualization by enabling analysts to display hundreds of combinations of data points, essentially creating a kill list with unprecedented precision. President Obama fundamentally transformed America's approach to covert warfare. Where Bush authorized 52 drone strikes outside war theaters in 8 years, Obama authorized 542 strikes, killing an estimated 3,797 people. Most significantly, Obama depoliticized targeted killing by making it acceptable across party lines, with the bin Laden raid representing the pinnacle of this new approach. How did assassination become normalized in American foreign policy? The journey began in 1928 when the Kellogg-Briand Pact outlawed war as nations sought peace after WW1. This idealism collapsed with Japan's invasion of Manchuria and Hitler's rise. After World War II, the National Security Act created the third option, covert action as the president's hidden hand, with assassination as its most extreme form. For 25 years, the CIA armed rebels and engineered coups until congressional oversight in the 1970s required presidential findings. Another 25 years of partisan approaches followed until 9/11, when a single paragraph reopened the floodgates. Now, CIA operators work in 138 countries worldwide, 70% of sovereign nations, as targeted killing accelerates beyond public awareness. Post 9/11, the CIA created a 12-member stalker team approved by President Bush. This team, which included two women and three targeting officers, developed dossiers on targets worldwide, preparing options from compromise to preemptive neutralization. The team operated under deep cover within CIA headquarters, hidden in budget and finance behind an accounts payable placard, an ironic nod to their mission. Their effectiveness depended on plausible deniability, the cornerstone of covert operations and America's hidden influence in global conflicts. We now inhabit a world where assassination has become bureaucratized and normalized. The president reviews kill lists on Terror Tuesdays, drones strike across sovereign borders, and the public remains largely indifferent. As we refine these techniques, critical questions emerge. What happens when other nations adopt our methods? What moral authority remains when we condemn others for targeted killings? Most crucially, can democracy survive when its most consequential actions occur in shadows, beyond public scrutiny or debate?